portray this as an attack on the company and its entire board, an issue of corporate governance, with Roy trying to block needed reforms, not of management's performance. They would not respond to Roy's specific allegations, since that would inevitably put the spotlight on Eisner and management. George Mitchell, the presiding director, was chosen to issue the statement the group drafted. Whether he yet realized it, Mitchell was being drawn into a precarious position. As a director, he owed a fiduciary duty to shareholders, not to Eisner or other Disney executives. He was now being asked to lend his reputation, bolstered by his Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating a truce in Northern Ireland, to defend Eisner and Disney management against Roy's charges. Mitchell issued a statement. The Governance and Nominating Committee recently informed Mr. Disney of its judgment that the mandatory age limits of the company's corporate governance guidelines, which had previously been unanimously approved by the board, should be applied to him and two other board members, Thomas S. Murphy and Raymond Watson. It is unfortunate that the committee's judgment to apply these unanimously adopted governance rules has become an occasion to raise again criticisms of the direction of the company and call for change in management that have been previously rejected by the board. The group spent considerable time trying to anticipate what would come next. Where was Gold in this picture? How would they deal with him at the board meeting? The situation promised to be exceedingly awkward now that Roy had resigned. How could the board discuss a counteroffensive with Gold telling everything to Roy, not to mention leaking to the press? Somehow, Gold would have to be neutralized. And, in typical fashion, Eisner ruminated on his long relationship with Roy, amazed that after all he had done to protect Roy and to show him respect, Roy, the idiot nephew, would now turn against him. Eisner remained convinced that it was all Gold's doing, and that Gold was acting out of selfish motives, still bitter that he hadn't been offered Wells's job, angry that Eisner wouldn't buy back the Bass's Disney shares, disgruntled that Eisner wouldn't listen to him. For the next week, Eisner's apartment in the Pierre became the command center, the inner circle joined by outside PR consultants and lawyers met every day to plot strategy. But no one was really worried, least of all Eisner. What could Roy and Gold do? This wasn't 1984. Roy and Gold weren't up against a weakened chief executive like Ron Miller. They didn't have the threat of a hostile takeover behind them or the support of anyone else on the board. There wasn't going to be any boardroom coup. Not with this board. It was too late to mount a proxy contest to elect new directors. Disney's 2004 annual meeting was in March, and under Disney bylaws, the deadline for submitting the names of alternate candidates was less than 3 weeks away. Anyway, Disney shares were so widely held that a proxy contest would be prohibitively expensive and probably doomed. All Roy had, really, was the Disney name. At the Shamrock offices in Burbank, discussion turned to how Stanley Gold should react. By remaining on the board, he would continue to have access to confidential financial information, as well as insights into the board's thinking. But he would also be muzzled by confidentiality agreements and fiduciary